From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, what's the takeaway message from Congress's last-minute deal?
Politicians, you know, are kind of like college students. They're extraordinarily good at working out a deal at 5 minutes to midnight or after pulling an all-night session to get the term paper done. And that actually, I think, is a pretty apt analogy.
Plus the ongoing crises facing children in developing nations. The rise and fall and rise again of a remarkable Milwaukee soccer club.
In the late 90s and the early 2000s, the club was really starting to gain a lot of recognition for not only being a wonderful recreational league giving opportunities to underprivileged children, but also for being a dominant soccer team.
And we'll preview the 2013 Milwaukee LGBT Film and Video Festival. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Faced with a midnight deadline for extending America's authority to borrow money, congressional leaders reached a long-awaited deal to raise the debt ceiling and reopen the federal government. The weeks-long showdown was watched closely at home and overseas, where financial trouble also could have resulted from a U.S. economic crisis. Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is a professor and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, and he's with us to talk about the crisis averted. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mitch. A pleasure.
Well, let me start with what might be an obvious question, but I'm curious to get your take on it. Is a deal to raise the debt ceiling and reopen the U.S. government leading to sighs of relief overseas?
I think it is, certainly in Washington and in the media and among those most directly involved among what's called the Washington establishment. That's the case, and it should be. The markets have been remarkably calm and stable. And why
is that? I would think with all this uncertainty, the markets might go into panic mode.
That's certainly true. And Fitch, one of the credit rating agencies, has been threatening to lower the credit rating of the United States government. Not unlike Standard & Poor's not too long ago. But I think as Herbert Hoover might say, the economy is fundamentally strong and sound in global terms, and unlike the situation when poor President Hoover was in office, that really is true today. Huge amounts of financial capital can be moved electronically. Markets can crash very quickly. The fact that that hasn't yet happened should be reassuring.
Maybe it's another obvious question, but would there be an impact on the world economy had the American borrowing authority expired, or is that something that you know, given the overall stability, could have been withstood for some time?
Well, that's a very good question. It hasn't happened, and I'm a professor, not a Wall Street or other financial operator, so in some ways I'm the last guy to ask. But yes, if we had a total freeze of the American political system, that could well trigger some kind of worldwide financial meltdown. We've never operated that way. We often operate on the basis of what might be called the perils of Pauline, referring to an earlier Herbert Hoover era. I mean, almost a melodramatic confrontation on a cliff of disaster. The congressmen and politicians, you know, are kind of like college students. They're extraordinarily good at working out a deal at 5 minutes to midnight or after pulling an all-night session to get the term paper done. And that actually, I think, is a pretty apt analogy. I'm not being glib.
And in terms of analogies as well, I mean, I think of the Wisconsin economy and what many people said has slowed things in this state in terms of the recovery. There was a lot of talk about uncertainty, whether mm-hmm. it was uncertainty about the presidential election, uncertainty about the recall election. Does uncertainty exact a price given that this solution is slated to expire in February?
I think it will exact a price in terms of public unhappiness with the Congress. Again, markets have remained quite stable. It's very interesting to bring up the state of Wisconsin, which does not, unlike Washington, unlike the state of Illinois, for example, Wisconsin has a well-balanced budget. Retirement pensions are well-funded. So beyond the political rhetoric, whether it's Governor Walker or former Governor Doyle, we've recovered from a severe recession particularly strongly because we don't have a hangover of debt, and the Republicans currently can take credit for things being in pretty good shape in Wisconsin. I do think the uncertainty in Washington makes every state and local authority, because they all have to borrow, makes things difficult for them. And there has been some upward blips in interest that has to be paid.
Well, and so what do you think the takeaway message for the average Wisconsinite ought to be from perhaps the tenor and the duration of this fight over the debt ceiling and the Affordable Care Act?
Well, historically, Wisconsin is rightly famous not only for progressive, meaning honest and forward-looking politics, but for pragmatic politicians until fairly recent years. And the relatively low standing of President Obama and Congress as an institution and other prominent national politicians makes me think that leaders should do whatever they can to get back to the old-fashioned but very workable, pragmatic kind of politics.
At the same time, there are signs that bipartisanship and compromise are not entirely dead. If they are in the U.S., they perhaps are not overseas, a prime example being in Germany.
Yeah. While the Americans seem increasingly rigid and some would say crazed and irresponsible in our approach to politics at the national level, Angela Merkel and her Christian Democratic Union, Christian and Allied Christian Social Union, the conservative umbrella party in the Federal Republic of Germany, they are working to build a coalition, probably with the other really big party, the Social Democratic Party. They've done that in the past. She had a coalition with a small Free Democratic Party, a free market traditional liberal party that was wiped out in the recent election. But the Germans, as usual in our time, in contrast to earlier times, of course, but the Germans are working things out in a pragmatic and realistic manner. And I must say, I'm a great admirer of the chancellor. She's been able to juggle these domestic political challenges. At the same time, she's been holding back strong forces in German opinion that they should not be underwriting Europe's debt. They should not be providing financial bailouts. And at the same time, she's been imposing rather stringent and tough-minded austerity measures on the European Union as a whole, especially the states like Greece famously, but also Italy, Spain, and a couple of others that have pretty high debt loads. It's quite a remarkable performance to date, and her leadership is something from which we can learn a lot of lessons, including the guys in Washington.
Well, and Russia fits into this puzzle as well, is that right?
Yes, indeed. Interestingly enough, both the German chancellor and President Putin of Russia spent their early years in East Germany. She was an academic and a relatively innocent one, but she lived in a very harsh system. Putin, of course, was working for the KGB, and East Germany was rightly notorious, famous for having a particularly tough and rough intelligence system. The Soviets hired a lot of Nazis after the war, did not persecute them, but rather did not punish them and prosecute them, but rather integrated them into their own intelligence system. So both these effective leaders, very different leaders, but both of these effective leaders emerged from a very, very tough earlier environment, in contrast to an increasing number of our national leaders who are post-Cold War.
And finally, a story that has perhaps flown under the radar of some this past week in the midst of the debt ceiling showdown. The U.S. military bestowed a significant honor on a hero from the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, William D. Swenson belatedly got the Medal of Honor. President Obama quite appropriately had a major ceremony yesterday. It seems to have been largely ignored by the media. I'm very happy and proud to report that public radio and public television covered this appropriately. As with other Medal of Honor winners from the beginning, he engaged in extraordinary, almost unbelievable heroism in rescuing wounded comrades and bringing back the bodies of dead comrades in the midst of a terrible firefight with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Officers safely in the rear had turned down a request for air cover because they were concerned that a nearby village and thereby innocent civilians might be injured and killed. When I was in the Army many years ago, there was a stock statement that there's a basic distinction between the name takers and the widow makers. And I am very sorry that that distinction remains true. The officers involved in this very bad decision, given that we are in the midst of a war there, received letters of reprimand, which is tantamount to the kiss of death in terms of a long-term military career. but nonetheless, emphasizing the positive, I'm very glad that this heroic man has received just recognition.
Well, Art Zier, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you and your colleagues.
Lake Effect contributor Art Zier is a professor of political economy and world business and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. A break now, and in just a moment, the head of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF on the organization's progress in reducing childhood deaths in the developing world. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Children everywhere are among the most vulnerable parts of the population, but nowhere more so than in the developing world. Despite exponential increases in modern medicine, children in countries such as Sierra Leone and Bangladesh face diseases long ago eradicated in much of the world. Carol Stern has traveled to many of those troubled places. She's president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, which supports humanitarian work in more than 190 countries around the world. The organization touts its drive toward zero children's deaths from conditions that can be prevented, treated, or cured. It's an effort that underpins Stern's book, I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, which she'll talk about tonight in Milwaukee. But first, she joins us on the line from UNICEF's Chicago office. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
The book, and one of the chapters in the book, and really an entire campaign through UNICEF is called I Believe in Zero. How close are we to the zero you are seeking?
Well, you know, today, as we are talking to each other, 18,000 children will die today, all under the age of five, all from causes we already know how to prevent and are just not doing our job. So we're 18,000 away from zero today.
How quickly can we expect changes in the places where UNICEF works? Take, for example, the situation you write about in Sierra Leone, in which a fairly expensive vaccine could make a huge difference in eradicating tetanus. How quickly can change come in a situation like that?
Well, to give you some context, you know, in the 1980s, over 30,000 kids were dying every single day. And so, you know, in the ensuing 30 years, we have halved that number. And the world's population during that period has tripled. So theoretically, if we had done nothing, there would be 90,000 kids dying every day. And when you think about the success rate, it's pretty remarkable. I always say, I wish I had a product that I had made that could show that success rate, because then I could finance what needs to happen for the world's children. So, you know, and in recent years, it's been more accelerated. You know, it isn't like it's a constant coming down every year. It has been more accelerated. So I would hope that in my lifetime, I will see that zero. To take a place like Sierra Leone, you know, the disease of tetanus, it will never be completely eradicated because it's a spore that lives on the ground. But we can eliminate it, and we have successfully eliminated it around the world in all but 20-something countries at this point.
You personally were not necessarily always involved in issues involving the world's children. How long did it take you not just to fully embrace the mission of UNICEF, but to embrace the role that you play in the organization?
You know, I came to UNICEF thinking I knew what it was about. You know, I'd had 30-plus years in the nonprofit world, and I could lead any organization, and oh my God, it's kids, I'm so passionate. I took my first trip, and that's where the book starts. I took my first trip to Mozambique, and I was in a clinic in the middle of nowhere with a mom who had just given birth, and, you know, I very smiley-faced and happy young woman, is this your first child? And she so matter-of-factly looked me in the face and said, well, it's the first one that lived. And I, in that moment, realized, you know, I'm not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy, and I really need to take a step back and talk to people and hear what their lives are like and see what their lives are like and touch and feel and experience it myself.
This is not just another nonprofit.
No, it's not. And it's not only just a nonprofit, because of the, you know, the just vast diversity of what UNICEF does every day somewhere in the globe. But it is managed well. It is a well-oiled machine on the one hand, and at the same time able to turn on a dime and be innovative and be tenacious, and is some of the most remarkable people I've ever had the privilege to work with.
You often compare your mission and the circumstances of the children you meet to your own family's experience in the Holocaust and in Nazi-occupied Europe. Why do you see that as such a powerful and appropriate comparison?
Well, you know, because my mom came to this country at the age of 6 years old with her brother, who was four. They were brought here by a woman whose last name they know, but whose first name they never knew, whom they never saw again. And so from a very early age, I learned from my mom repeatedly that one person can make a difference, because I wouldn't be here if not for this woman. And at the same time, my grandfather was on a boat, the SS St. Louis, which is often called the Voyage of the Damned, which wasn't allowed to dock anywhere in the world. And ultimately, most of its passengers, you know, it returned to Europe and most of its passengers perished. But my grandfather lived, and I heard his story, too. He sat in a harbor outside of Cuba for 40 days while the world debated, what do we do with these people? And everybody, even the U.S., turned, you know, we turned our back on them. And so I also heard very early on what it means to not give a damn, to not be part of the solution. So it's not at all unusual that both my brother and I ended up in giving and caring professions, because that's the lesson we got at home from our earliest ages.
At one point, you reference advice you were given. I think it was going into one of the refugee camps in Darfur, but I might be mistaken. But the advice was you shouldn't promise anything, because the field staff, for as good as it is, might not be equipped to deliver on that promise. It must be hard to see such suffering and at the same time not be able to promise anything specific except that you will try to help.
It's really hard. It's really hard sometimes, even something as silly as knowing I have a bag of Jolly Ranchers in my backpack and there's children in front of me, and I find myself mentally counting, you know, how many kids and how many do I think I have in the bag? Because, you know, you don't want to take it out and give it to one child, right? Something as simple as a piece of candy, and then you multiply that when it's the glass of water that stands between life and death. Or it's the mom you're looking at, you know, straight in the eyes, knowing that 70 cents would have bought the vaccine that would have saved her child, and that you spend more than that on your cup of coffee every morning.
Well, so how do you cope with it?
How do you cope with it? You know, I wish I had a really good answer. The best answer I can give you is some days better than others. You know, people always say to me, how do you not cry? My response is, what makes you think I don't? You know, I'm not a superhuman, and I definitely cry. I've shed a lot of tears out there. But I also have seen the tenacity of human spirit. I've seen that the children of the world don't see themselves as victims. They're survivors of heroic things and horrific things. And that they believe so dearly that tomorrow could be better that you can't help but get caught up in their optimism.
Well, and I would imagine it would be really easy to have everything you do be driven by guilt of, you know, that you're leaving there at the end of the day or the week, or guilt that you're going home to your family, which, you know, has everything in comparison to the people that you're with.
Yeah, but I will also tell you that there are lots of things in some of the developing nations that we've lost sight of that are remarkable. You know, I talk about it in the book, how I would go to some of the poorest villages, and as the jeeps would drive in, people pour out of their huts and they sing to you, because all they have is to give you is their voice. And I've probably been sung to that way, I don't know, maybe 50 or 100 times now. And that's the time I've never made it without crying. It is the most magnificent sound you will ever hear. Or I went with women who have to go and fetch the water, and that they sing and dance their way to the river, and there's a sense of community that I don't feel in my hometown that is remarkable. None of these make up for or replace the things that they need, but there are things we can learn from these people. And I guess that's the big lesson for me in all of this, is I came in thinking I knew it. I realized I knew nothing. And I never really had thought about before I took the job how much I would learn as I went through it all.
One of the other really powerful recurrent images is this idea that pretty much everywhere you have gone, there are scenes of children really just being children.
Oh, absolutely. I always said there were three things that have been the same no matter where I go. And the first is that wherever there are kids, there is some kind of ball. You know, I mean, it's like man is inherently, you know, we have to play with a ball. Because In the U.S., it's leather, it's plastic, and in most of the nations I go to, it's rags tied with string. But in absolutely every place I've ever been, some kid is kicking it and some kid is kicking it back. And they're laughing. Or when a baby is born, no matter how poor the family is, that baby's healthy, there is rejoicing. And there is love. It's amazing. So one is the ball. The second is that my lap is not my property. You know, if I sit on the ground long enough in any place in the world, a kid is going to come and sit on me. It's phenomenal. They don't speak my language. They don't ask permission. They just kind of plop down. And it feels just as good anywhere in the world to have a kid who you don't know feel safe with you. But the third thing is that we all want the same things for our kids. We want them to be happy. We want them to be healthy. We want them to go to bed with their bellies full. We want them to dream really, really, really big dreams. And we want to be part of making those dreams come true.
Do you also see a takeaway message for people, living in cities in this country, places like Milwaukee, where there are also crises in children's health, things like infant mortality and really similar situations where otherwise preventable diseases are, if not common, certainly more common in these places than they are in more affluent communities?
Well, I think that if a child suffers, no matter what their geography is, it's horrible. So it isn't a matter of which place is worse. It shouldn't be an either. It's an and. But there are some advantages in the United States. When a child is born in the U.S., even a migrant child, the child gets a birth certificate. They exist. There's some record of their existence. We have laws that define them as a child until they reach 18. Education is not a privilege in this country. It's a law and it's a right. You're mandated to go. So there's public schools without fees. In order to go to those schools, you have to be immunized, so immunizations are made available to children. There is a shelter system. No hospital will turn a baby that's dying away. There is all kinds of things that we have that the developing world does not have.
So even as you're trying to do things to directly impact children's health, provide vaccines and make these changes, is it also UNICEF's role to work behind the scenes to try to pressure these countries into making policy changes like something as simple as birth certificates?
Absolutely. We work upstream as well as downstream. So we work to get school fees eliminated. We work to get birth registries in place. I'll go back to Haiti. After the earthquake, the first night, the main thing that I needed to do was to go out and try and get as many digital cameras as I could possibly get my hands on. And then when I flew into Haiti, we were literally taking pictures of kids and creating registries because children got separated from their families, and it was many weeks till you knew who was dead, who was alive, where people were. And you had a lot of people trying to claim children were theirs who weren't theirs. And so we started to create registries there. So sometimes we're actually doing it. Sometimes we are working to abolish school fees. All over Africa, we've had school fees abolished in many countries, making it possible for a poor child to go to school.
Have you gotten any better at dealing with bugs?
No. I want to say yes, but my kids will tell you no. I'm still like that woman who stands on the chair when the spider's on the floor. No, I haven't. I hate things that crawl. And when I was getting ready to go to Sudan, and I went through this entire security training class, and I was fine when I was learning, what do you do if they want to take your Jeep? What do you do if somebody wants to shoot at you? I mean, I was really fine on all of that. And then we got to the, how do you shake your sleeping bag out to make sure there's no scorpion? And I almost didn't go on the trip.
Well, Carol Stern, we will try to keep the bugs out of Milwaukee while you are here.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. That's why I like to travel much better in the winter.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and the story of UNICEF with us.
Well, thank you so much. And if anyone is interested, unicefusa.org, you can find out lots of information about how to get involved.
Carol Stern is the president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF and author of the book I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, published by St. Martin's Press. She'll talk about her work this evening in a conversation that I'll be moderating at the Milwaukee Public Library. There is more information about it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Children in Milwaukee once formed a powerhouse soccer club called Simbas. The club folded a few years back but is making perhaps an underdog comeback. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Thousands of kids in the Milwaukee area play youth soccer, but the vast majority of the sport is played by kids who live outside the city itself. But nearly 20 years ago, a local club went a long way towards expanding soccer's footprint here to the inner city. It was a club called the Simbas, and after some years of success, the club folded in 2006. But an effort is underway to bring it back. The history and the future of the Simbas is chronicled in an article in the October Milwaukee Magazine by James Carlton, who joins us now. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
What makes the Simbas story so important to hear, in your estimation?
Well, besides the fact that I was personally involved with it journalistically, I think that there's I think often people see these stories as some sort of cliche or archetypal sports story. You know, like underprivileged minorities succeeding in sports or in life is some sort of inspirational genre. And I think a lot of times people lose sight of the fact that these stories involve real people. And especially here in Milwaukee, having been here and having played for the Simbas and living here now, I think that we look for structures and people to lead and to sort of there's a lot of angsting and complaining and retching about how to fix the inner city or how to improve high school graduation rates, how to decrease crime. And, you know, I think a lot of people are looking for adults to be role models and structures to be in place where that can help aid that effort. And I think that the Simbas was that, and they were demonstrably that for quite a few years. And the fact that very few people knew about them, the people, the adults, especially the kids, and the fact that it eventually went away is incredibly sad. And I think it does sort of speak to that feeling in this city that those are almost hopeless endeavors often. But it is coming back now. And I think that that is also one of the reasons why it's inspiring and possibly very encouraging.
We'll talk about the first birth of this club. What was youth soccer like in Milwaukee when the Simbas came along at first, and where did they fit in?
Well, youth soccer in Milwaukee, it was then, and it still is now, dominated by white suburbanism, sort of a pay-to-play structure. And it often excludes minorities, people that can't afford to play, people that can't afford to get to pristine soccer fields or travel out to the suburbs to play against good opponents. And it's really sad because it is one of the sports that really doesn't require a lot of equipment. It really doesn't require a lot of infrastructure to be in place. But that's sort of the nature of the beast, given that soccer is not a popular common sport here. It's sort of left by the wayside. Football and basketball are especially popular in the inner cities. And that was the dominating prevailing theme throughout, obviously, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. I would say probably still today, although it is making a lot of inroads in the inner cities. But when Simbas came along, I was the brainchild of Floyd DeBow and Jimmy Banks, who both didn't know each other, but both had a very similar vision, both very proud and very proactive Milwaukeeans. Jimmy Banks, obviously coming from a World Cup background in soccer, arguably the most accomplished soccer player ever to come out of this state, but also a very low-key persona, had an amazing coach's mind and obviously a very, very accomplished playing career. And he had a vision to create a environment for soccer in Milwaukee where, as he said to me, boys could be playing with their boys.
Meaning that these weren't going to be inner city kids that they would just take and just drop on a team full of white suburban kids.
Right, exactly. Because it was a completely barren landscape in Milwaukee for urban soccer. You played basketball, you played football, or you know you didn't play soccer. It was the black sheep of sports, so to speak. And Jimmy came back and started the Jimmy Banks Soccer League, which was a great effort. But you know, given his reserved, low-key persona, he needed a little bit of charisma to be infused into his vision for an urban Milwaukee soccer club. And that's where Floyd DeBow came along. Unbeknownst to both of them, he was doing sort of the same thing with the Milwaukee Kickers. His son had been playing with a lot of all-white teams, was a very good player, but felt ostracized and alienated on those teams, or at the very least excluded from them. And Floyd, being as proactive and outspoken and positive as he is about creating equal opportunities for minorities, he decided to change that from the inside, joining up with Milwaukee Kickers and ultimately becoming the executive or the chairman of the board. And he found out that Jimmy Banks was doing something very similar and basically got in the car, drove right over to Jimmy's office at the Boys and Girls Club and said, "We're doing the same thing. Let's join up."
and the Simbas took off. What was the high water mark, would you say, for the club?
In the late 90s, in the early 2000s, the club was really starting to gain a lot of recognition for not only being a wonderful recreational league giving opportunities to underprivileged children, but also for being a dominant soccer team. A couple of the older teams at that time, a couple of the older high school teams were winning their Premier League. They were finishing as runner-ups in state cups and finishing as top finalists in national tournaments. They were sending kids, some of their players, onto the national team and the national pool of the Olympic Development Program and sending kids to Japan and Brazil and having their players play all over the world. After the Simbas broke from Kickers and became an independent club in the early 2000s, that's really when the team was sort of at its pinnacle.
The Kickers have stayed around. They are still, by and large, the dominant recreational soccer program in the region. What led to the demise of the Simbas?
Well, that's a source of a lot of disagreement or perhaps selective memories. I think the one thing that became clear in talking to several different people with different perspectives on the situation was that everyone agreed that it was a wonderful program, the Simbas, and as well as the Central City Initiative, which was the recreational umbrella program, but specifically those competitive Simba Select teams, that they were doing great things and that it was obviously a very successful on-the-field team. And that there was a lot of disagreement on how exactly it should be run. There was some disagreements on where the resources should be going and who should be controlling them. You know, a lot of the two words that came up the most were personalities and politics. And I think, as with many boardrooms, the Milwaukee Kickers boardroom at that time and probably still today contained a lot of big personalities with differing ideas, and there was boardroom politics that came up. And Floyd Dubow ultimately felt that what he was doing with the Simbas was an operation that he could be doing alone and independently and with control singularly by himself and with Jimmy Banks, and that he didn't need the Kickers' help. And so he went off and, as he said, I took my ball and went home.
So what has happened today to allow for the return of the Simbas? Who is behind this latest incarnation?
It's actually it brings a smile to my face, but I think it's also a testament to what the Simbas were at the time. It was a family, and you see that manifested in the people that are bringing it back now. Demetrius White was probably, arguably, one of the most singularly affected members of the Simba team. He came from almost nothing and took soccer about as far as he could take it, both literally and figuratively. He traveled the world to Brazil and Japan and France, playing with U.S. and regional teams, and ultimately decided to come back to Milwaukee to start a family. And a couple of very tragic events in his life led him to sort of evaluate what was important to him and what was important to people, kids like him when he was growing up, and that was always the Simbas. It was a family to him then, and he's trying to create that family now. He's doing it almost single-handedly now. He's got Floyd Dubow pulling some strings in the background and advising and consulting for him. But D is really doing it a lot on his own. And he's got a couple of the other former Simba guys come back now and sort of coming full circle to help him out and offer whatever services they can, whether it's coaching, whether it's financial understanding and filing for 501c3 applications and all sorts of things like that. It's really touching to see the manifestation of that Simba family mentality that we speak of so frequently.
As someone who has been involved with the Simbas as a player and as a reporter, are you optimistic that it's going to work?
I am. I'm cautiously optimistic. To remove myself from having played with them, I think Demetrius and the people that he's surrounding himself with now are more realistic about the process. I think there's an understanding that it needs to be a slow and steady process. I spoke with Demetrius just a couple of days ago just to see where they're at, how they're moving forward. And he likes to call them the baby Simbas, and he likes to say the baby Simbas are making baby steps. They've got four teams right now playing in COA Milwaukee Youth and Family Center leagues. So there's a focus on keeping it insular and really nurturing the development of these new Simbas without throwing them into a big recreational league like the Kickers. And there's plans to come wintertime, move them indoors and continue the same, have the same infrastructure in place and continue to practice and play games. And then come springtime, you know, start to really develop these kids, maybe establish an academy for them and start putting them into potentially competitive leagues.
Well, thank you so much for shedding some light on this kind of underrepresented story.
Thanks so much for having me.
James Carlton's article on the Simba's soccer club called The Lion Awakens is in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The Milwaukee LGBT Film and Video Festival gets underway tonight. One last break, and we'll get a preview of the festival's offerings. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. The 28th annual Milwaukee LGBT Film and Video Festival opens this evening at the Oriental Theater. The opening night celebration includes a showing of the documentary I Am Divine about the life and career of the actor and performer Divine. The festival, sponsored by UW Milwaukee, features domestic movies, foreign ones, documentaries, comedies, and dramas over its four-day run. Festival director Carl Bogner spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about the festival, starting with opening night.
This year, to open the festival, we've invited a local personality, Karen Valentine, to serve as MC. She'll be presiding over our opening night screening. Karen Valentine, also known as Michael Johnson, is a wonderful friend of the festival, a great, I think, singular personality, but also has a singular relationship to film in terms of his incredible knowledge base and what delights him about cinema. He's also something of a showman. Opening night has been characteristically hosted by a rather dry-as-dust academic. So there's a sense that given what we're showing on opening night, it would only make sense to invite a personality who knows how to embrace the largeness of film, the largeness of life, as a way of introducing the screening.
Which, of course, and you alluded to it, is the reason for Karen Valentine's presence is I Am Divine, which is the opening night movie, which is, of course, about Divine.
And I don't mean to presume that everybody knows who Divine is or already cherishes Divine. It's been interesting to meet the topic of Divine with my students, who may seem as a more exotic creature, may not be understood as a necessary figure, which some of us, myself included, hold to. Necessary because I think Divine remains a shocking figure, someone who challenges a host of status quos, whether it be about gender or body type or taste. Divine is wonderfully uncontainable. The movie is wonderfully accessible. I mean, Divine's life could have deliberately and perhaps antically been given a tabloid kind of approach, given the excesses of John Waters and company. John Waters, the filmmaker, who was also something of a Svengali for Divine, ushering Divine into a film career in the midnight movies that they made together. But I watching Pink Flamingos or Female Trouble Now, Divine, I think, still has this incredible energy and this capacity to shock in a way that I don't think – maybe things can't be shocking like that anymore, or maybe people don't try. I would say there's something political and aesthetic about the shock, which is what I love about it.
And if you have seen Divine movies before, it's fun to get re-shocked, if you will, and see them again. There's nothing wrong with that. What I liked about this documentary is that – It fills in some gaps. I mean, for people that think they know a lot about Divine and Divine's life and career, and you don't, unless you're really, really well-versed. I mean, I didn't know about some of the early movies. I didn't know that, not Divine, but the actual actor behind Divine was going to be on Married with Children before he died. I had no idea.
What's great about the documentary is Jeffrey Schwartz's film really cherishes Divine as a performer, as a working artist. The film follows the trajectory of Divine's career. A lot of the movie is about his time outside of John Waters' films, the recording career, the stage career that Divine had. And it meant a great deal to Divine, Divine feeling like he was being recognized as an actor, as a performer, when towards what he didn't know was to be the end of his life, that he's being given parts where he would play male characters. In Alan Rudolph's film where he played a gangster, and then also, yes, he was supposed to start taping a recurring role on the sitcom Married with Children the day after he died.
Okay, and that's opening night. Now, I like the variety of movies that that are available at this festival. One of them is about not just about the poet Elizabeth Bishop, but it's about her, mainly her life and the time she spent in Brazil. And then if you like history, I mean, the woman that she was living with was also an architect who designed some parks or a major park on the waterfront in Rio de Janeiro. So that wasn't a big part of the film, but it's just interesting to see how their lives were commingled for a while.
This film, Reaching for the Moon, by the Brazilian director Bruno Barreto, is about the American poet Elizabeth Bishop's sojourn in Brazil. She went for what she called a geographic cure. The movie sort of presents it as her trying to recover from perhaps a creative and personal malaise. And so she went to Brazil to visit an old college friend and ended up staying for 12 years and having a very passionate romance with her college friend's girlfriend at the time. Right. And you're right. One of the pleasures of it is it's a portrait of two working artists struggling to have a life together. And it's by a Brazilian director, so it very much presents the idea of this perhaps repressive Yankee who blossoms once in the tropics of Brazil, both artistically and romantically.
I would recommend that anyone that sees that movie just do a quick Wikipedia, get some background on that era in Brazil. It might help you understand a little bit more. And also that night, there's the Adventures of James Broughton.
Yes, Big Joy, The Adventures of James Broughton, a documentary about this lifelong bohemian. The movie is very much a history of the San Francisco art scene. Broughton, an experimental filmmaker and poet who emerged as an artist after World War II, collaborating with pretty much everybody in the field of experimental film, dance, poetry, theater. And he seems most San Franciscan in the forms of his bohemianness, the whimsy and silliness of his films, the anticness of his poetry, his eventual status as something of a gay liberator, his delight in all things flesh, and his sense of personal freedom.
You also have three shorts presentations. We won't talk about all these, but there will be an evening of men's shorts, women's shorts, and trans shorts.
Yeah, we have a very enterprising shorts committee that puts together some, I think, really dynamic and exciting collections of international short films that we'll be presenting each night at the Union Theater.
What is on Saturday, 11 a.m., is I Am Woman Now. Tell us about that one.
Oh, it might be the most beautiful film we're showing. It's a documentary about five trans women. They could be understood as the first generation of transsexuals, each of these women having gone to the same doctor in Casablanca for surgery to transition from men to women. And the movie interviews these women now in their 70s about how their lives were for the last five decades. They're all of different stripes, I would say, or you know, some with great flamboyance and regalness, others with a determined, I'd call it ordinariness, in that it's as ordinary as you or I in the terms of the way they lead their daily lives. They're a striking collection of really impressive figures, confident in their life choices, open about any sort of hardships or struggles that they faced. But they all have such bravado, I think, that they're great company. And the movie weaves together the five conversations with these European women from Northern Europe and also England, weaves together their conversations as they talk about their lives. And the cinematography is just gorgeous. I mean, this is a great movie to inhabit because the company of the women is so engaging, and it's beautiful to look at.
And right after that is a pretty interesting documentary called The New Black, about the passage of the Question 6 referendum in Maryland, which would be, I think at the time, it was the first time that gay marriage would be voted in or allowed via vote as opposed to a legislative process or a judicial process. So, but it really focuses on the African-American community and how crucial the vote was there.
Yeah, it was a historic achievement. The people of Maryland approved same-sex marriage. It's the first time it's happened. The election was a real game changer. And the movie uses that election last November in Maryland as a framing device to consider the ideas around LGBT identity within the African-American community, concentrating specifically on the African-American church or African-American churches and how pastors in those churches would work either for or against the referendum. The movie works to contain a lot of recent history within this context of exploring what happened in the Maryland election, charting, for instance, the changing attitudes of our president on same-sex marriage, looking at the defeat around Proposition 8 in California and how immediately when the rights of same-sex couples was lost in that election in California, how the African-American community was publicly discussed as the cause of that. So this movie sort of in many ways, it took that on as a challenge to wonder if was that really the case? Is that what's happening in Maryland? Who are the people within the African American community who are working to address that? And the best thing about the movie is that we're just the filmmaker Yoruba Riken had incredible access, and we're privy to a lot of really great conversations. Pastors who are fighting against same-sex marriage are frankly open with her, and we hear their discussions around same-sex marriage. The film goes into the kitchens and the homes of many community members who are having really detailed, thorny, thoroughgoing discussions about LGBT people. So it's just get the documentary just allows you to be privy to a community really grappling with this issue.
And also on Saturday, some foreign films, which I'm always intrigued to, and I don't think I've – while I was watching it, I don't think I've ever seen a film from Poland of any kind.
We're very fortunate to be able to present the film In the Name Of, about a priest who we learned probably entered the priesthood as a way to shield himself from his sexuality. And we meet him as he is in a new position. We learn that he has a history of having been moved around, but he is the sort of spiritual guide for something of a halfway house for these young men who have been in some sort of reform school and who are at this place in a rural village on their way out to the world. And the priest meets this sort of strange young man, strange because he's silent mostly, who lives in the area. And his desires for this person stir troubles that he thought he had control of. The fact that the movie supports or values this priest's struggle, I think, is a way of offering a portrait of this world in which this priest is dealing with his personal demons. The movie is both really, I think, a genuinely beautiful love story and also just a beautiful movie about someone claiming something about themselves, but also it's a really chilling portrait of repression. I mean, the world that we meet in this film is brutal, blunt, masculinist. The capacity for ugliness or violence to erupt can happen in any scene. And the movie suggests that this man's vulnerabilities, his sensitivities, his spirituality and his desires are the only sort of things that make sense in this really cold world. And where this movie posits that gayness can exist makes for a really chilling portrait of a very repressive society.
All right, well, let's move on to the last day, Sunday, and the 11 a.m. movie, Lesbiana, A Parallel Revolution. That's interesting.
I think the movie does merit an explanation point because it's so good, but I just want to clarify for the listeners that there isn't an explanation point after Lesbiana. It's something of a road movie. The Quebecois filmmaker traveling across Canada and the United States to visit with women for whom the 70s were a time of both sexually and politically coming out. She interviews women for whom the women's movement of the 70s, or as understood in the 70s, was a time of great self-actualization. Their coming out as a lesbian for them was also entering into a political movement. Many of these women who she interviews interested in and engaging in intentional communities where they could structure a world defined by feminist politics, structure a world that was structured by other women. And it at first what may seem like a conventional sort of serial interview movie or like one interview after another, I thought just grew with such great warmth. I mean, these women who she talks to are mostly in their 60s or 70s, and they have a very frank and varied and reflective response to their time in the 70s. One of the things I like best about this film was that it doesn't have a uniform assessment of the period, but everyone talks about it in such positive ways about how edifying and fulfilling it was. By saying that not everyone has the same assessment, we meet this one woman for whom what seemed like the form of spirituality that seemed to inflect a number of the women's activities that she was going to didn't really speak to her, and it allowed her to rediscover her Judaism. Or we meet an African-American woman for whom the lack of diversity in the intentional community that she considered engaging with suggested that her feminist pursuits may have to take a different route. So I just find, you know, it's not unlike I'm a Woman Now that we talked about. We get to be in the company of really articulate people reflecting back on the risks they took in realizing themselves. And they do so, I think, with great insight, with real warmth, often great humor.
So I want to talk about the last movie, which is such a kind of a nice way to end, I guess. It's a movie from Taiwan, but a very – it's just – I think you described it in the literature as sweet.
It is sweet, and I don't mean to be flip about the word sweet. Something that is very hard to do is to make a successfully light film, a film that is sweet, generally so, and funny and – able to deal with issues of the heart in not a dismissive or derisive way. And I think Arvin Chen, the director of this film, has made one of the most successful romantic comedies I've ever seen, in part because I think he has an attitude about romance as an available fantasy that we can all engage in. And the movie, which is primarily about this optometrist, a married man, married to a woman, they also have a son who, when he meets this very dapper airline steward who comes into his eyeglass shop, finds his world somewhat unmoored because of his desires for this man. And the movie presents his romantic befuddlement, as befuddlement, not as melodrama, and also presents it in the context of a number of characters who are similarly confused about their attractions and their desires. A number of characters, I should mention, gay and straight, within which our hero's understandings of what desires he feels like he can pursue are articulated. And the movie has a great sense of whimsy, a great sense of play. There's, I'd say, grace notes that inhabit the movie, where characters may suddenly levitate, a karaoke scene may turn into a full-blown musical number, soap opera characters on TV emerge into people's living rooms to offer romantic counsel. And it's all done with such a light touch. I find it a really pleasurable film.
Well, Carl Bogner, thank you for coming back on Lake Effect.
Dan Harmon, I appreciate the chance to have this conversation about the films we're showing, so thanks a lot.
Carl Bogner is director of the Milwaukee LGBT Film and Video Festival, which runs tonight through Sunday at the Oriental and UWM Union Theaters. He spoke with Dan Harmon, and there is a link to more about the festival from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Thursday's program. I'm Mitch Teich. Great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.